Good day. Today is Saturday, 16th May 2026, and before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, I make my program today a day after the president of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky, made a series of very interesting statements which suggest a mood of growing edginess in Kiev and perhaps worries about the long-term direction of the war, or perhaps I should correct that, the short-term direction of the war. Outwardly, Ukraine, Zelensky himself remained defiant. The Ukrainians have been very busy over the last few weeks promoting in the media, in the Western media, the narrative that they're not only holding their own on the battlefronts, but that they're actually regaining territory from the Russians. Where exactly they are doing this is not always easy to tell, but when you drill through the various articles, it's clear that these are references to the two counter-offensives or counter-attacks that the Ukrainians carried out, one in Zaporozhye region, firstly in eastern Zaporozhye over the course of February and March, and then following that, the counter-attacks in western Zaporozhye along the eastern bank of the Dnieper River. Now, as far as I'm aware, both of those offensives have stalled and have gone into reverse, with the Russians regaining ground. But I will return to the situation, the actual situation in Zaporozhye region and elsewhere on the battlefronts later in this program. Let's go first to what Vladimir Zelensky was saying. And basically what he said was this, that he believes that the Russian command has resolved to target him personally and the rest of the Ukrainian leadership, that Ukrainian intelligence has obtained access to secret plans by the Russians to attack central Kiev, to attack the decision-making centres in Kiev itself, to kill him, Zelensky, and the other top leaders of Ukraine. And all of this in conjunction with ongoing preparations by the Russians for a further offensive on Kiev from the north, from the territory of Belarus. And Zelensky went on to say that Ukraine is now busy trying to prepare for this oncoming Russian offensive from the north, and that he has given the Ukrainian military orders to prepare for it. Now, what are we to make of all of this? And is any of this true? Well, I'm not sure that it is true in terms of actual Russian intentions. The Russians, 2 weeks ago, published warnings that they would indeed attack central Kiev, targeting the decision-making centres there, in the event that there was an attack on the victory parade in Moscow on the 9th of May. And as I've discussed in several programmes, the Russian President Vladimir Putin apparently warned President Trump of the United States that this would indeed happen over the course of their telephone conversation on the 29th of April. In fact, it seems that the main purpose of that call, which was initiated by the Russians, was so that Putin could convey his warning or threat, if you prefer, to Trump, who heeded it. and who took steps to ensure immediately after that there was, in fact, no Ukrainian attack, no Ukrainian drone attack on Russia's Victory Day parade on the 9th of May. So the Russians have said that they do have plans, contingency plans, to conduct an attack on central Kiev, on the decision-making centres. But when publishing the warning, the Russian Defence Ministry said that this had been something that Russia had intentionally avoided doing before, and it did seem that it did seem from the Russian Defense Ministry statement that the Russians would only do it in the event that there was an extreme provocation like the attack that I've just been discussing, this proposed Ukrainian attack on the Victory Day parade on the 9th of May. So the Russians do have plans to conduct an attack on the decision-making centres in Kiev, but they've imposed conditions on themselves for doing it, which might argue that they have no plan to do it at the moment. Now, it's important to say that plans can change, that restrictions that might remain in effect might be lifted. Putin himself confirmed that he had authorized the attack on central Kiev in the event that there had been an attack on the Victory Day parade in Moscow. So on the assumption that the restrictions, the prohibition of an attack on central Kiev had previously come from him, we see that he is prepared in certain circumstances to withdraw that prohibition. But do we have any reason to think, as Zelensky says, that Putin is thinking about doing that now? Well, there have been plenty of drone attacks by Ukraine on Russia and on Russian territory. There was another big drone attack by the Ukrainians yesterday. Some of the drones do get through. Some of the drones do inflict damage. Some drones, for example, landed on a base of the Russian Caspian fleet yesterday. There's the usual big bang and flash, but we have no way of knowing how much actual damage was done. And always after these attacks, the reports appear to say that the damage that was done was relatively light. Ukrainian drones are small and fragile and light. The amount of explosive they carry in their warheads is small. They're not able to do much damage to big industrial facilities or hardened military positions. The Ukrainians can sometimes have a lucky strike, or they can attack storage tanks in oil refineries which are open to the sky, and which, if a drone strikes them, well, can cause a large fire and lots of smoke and soot. But overall, the amount of damage that these drone attacks inflict is never very large, despite the commentaries that might suggest otherwise in the West. And I, who follow Russian economic news closely, can say with confidence that so far these drone attacks have had no visible effect on the performance of the Russian economy. In fact, Russian economic growth rebounded in March, precisely in the month when Ukrainian drone attacks were at their peak, just saying. And, well, the Russian authorities have also released information about the number of civilian casualties that Russia suffered over the May 9th holiday, the 3 or 4 days of the ceasefire, when the Ukrainians were conducting some attacks. And the Russian authorities say that 4 civilians were killed. On other days, when there is no ceasefire, of course it is more. But anyway, we can see that we're not talking about situations where huge air raids cause massive loss of life and massive destruction. This is simply not the scenario that is playing out. I don't believe that these drone attacks in and of themselves would be sufficient for Putin or for the Russian leadership to make a decision to come after Zelensky himself and the other leaders of Ukraine. But that is a guess. There are people in Russia who do advocate for these things. Mostly, so far as I can tell, they're bloggers and people of that kind. I doubt that they have much political influence, but certainly those demands are indeed there. But anyway, let's go back to Zelensky's statements and ask ourselves, is there any other reason why he might fear this? And, well, I'm going to suggest that he might indeed be worried that something like this might happen, though perhaps not quite as soon as he implies, if there is going to be, at some point in the future, another Russian offensive directed at Kiev itself. Now, for the moment, I think we are some distance away from this. But as we will discuss shortly, the Russians have made significant progress in northeastern Ukraine, in Kharkiv region and in Sumy region recently. And we've had some very dramatic battlefield developments in Kharkiv region, especially with announcements made by the Russians over the last 24 hours. And since it is from this area, not, by the way, from Belarus, that I would expect the big blow against Kiev to come, and as I suspect that an attack on Kiev itself, where he is personally located, is for Zelensky himself the biggest single strategic nightmare, the thing he fears most. I can imagine that the latest developments on the front lines have indeed rattled him, and that this is what lies behind his latest panicky statements that the Russians are coming to kill him and are prepared to conduct strikes against Kiev. Given the psychological pressures which must always be there, it's not difficult to see how a conjunction of events in Kharkiv region, especially over the last few days, taken together with the known fact that the Russians just over a week ago were threatening strikes on central Kiev, how those things taken together with further reports about a Russian build-up in Belarus, might be causing Zelensky fear and worry and anxiety about his own safety and about the safety of the overall government in Kiev itself. So that is my own speculation. Now, of course, with Zelensky, there might be other factors at play. He may be doing what he often does, projecting himself as the valiant, tragic hero, holding back the forces of darkness. There would be reasons why he might do that. Aid from the West is drying up. I'm going to return to that later in this program. The President of the United States seems to have lost interest in the Ukraine conflict and in him, and appears to blame Zelensky for the failure to achieve any progress, to achieve a negotiated end to the war. And of course, Zelensky is under domestic pressure from the legal proceedings, which have led to charges being brought against his former chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, with information that Yermak has been remanded to prison for 60 days, and with reports circulating inside Kiev itself that Zelensky might at some point be identified as a co-conspirator directly implicated in the Firepoint corruption scandal. So the pressures on Zelensky are considerable, and putting aside whatever information he might have about the Russians, it's perhaps in character that, as I said, he would want to cut a heroic pose at this time, project himself to the Ukrainian people and to the West as the hero after whom the Russians are coming, and that this might, in its own strange way, be a plea for further support and aid from the West. So anyway, we shall see exactly what this is all about. But for the record, my own view is that Zelensky, despite everything, is reasonably confident of the West's support. I suspect that he understands well the constraints on further Western aid. His priority is to keep Ukraine in the war, because that is the condition upon which his political survival depends. And I think it is the military developments that are driving these comments, and that they do tell us what his underlying fears and insecurities are, and that these do centre on a return of the Russians to Kiev, even though that event is still quite a lot of time away. Now, that does bring me to what is happening over the battlefronts. And again, last night, even as the Ukrainians were conducting their own drone attacks on Ukraine, the Russians were sending more drones, more Garand drones, into the skies over Ukraine, and were inflicting more damage upon Ukraine. These Russian attacks, these Garand drone strikes, now take place every night. They vary in scale and intensity, but in every case, one does get the sense that Ukrainian air defences are basically absent. There were reports, by the way, yesterday, that a Russian fighter jet shot down a F-16 flying over Ukraine, that it was shot down using air-to-air missiles. The Ukrainians have rushed out claims that they too have destroyed two Russian aircraft, that this supposedly was on the ground. I have no information about any of this, but the point is that, as I've discussed in various programmes, the reality, the true reality in the conflict, is that the balance in the war of the sky, in the war in the sky, continues to tilt very heavily in Russia's favour. If Zelensky is indeed becoming nervous, it is because of developments on the front lines. And this is where I'm going to come to the latest report from the Russian commander-in-chief, Valery Gerasimov. He has again toured the front lines. He's visited one of the headquarters in Ukraine, in the area of the special military operation. And he's given another update about military developments. And it is, as always with Gerasimov, a very interesting one, regardless of how factually accurate you believe it to be. Now, the most important thing that Gerasimov said, the two most important things that Gerasimov said, is firstly that Liman, the town that has been heavily contested and which lies to the west of Slavyansk and which the Russians have been fighting for now for some months, and which lies on a hill overlooking Slavyansk. Well, according to Gerasimov, the Russians now control 85% of the town. The Ukrainians certainly will dispute this, but the reality is that there's been very little information coming from Liman for some time. That is usually a sign that the Russians have been exercising extremely tight control of information flow from Liman. And that, by the way, leads me to think that what Gerasimov says is likely to be true. One thing we have known for some time is that there are Russian forces located to the west of Liman, both north and south, and that suggests that Liman has for some time been taken by the Russians into a semicircle, that it is in effect virtually encircled, and there's been many reports that the supply lines for the Ukrainian garrison in Liman have either been cut or greatly reduced in their effectiveness. And that would, of course, be consistent with a situation such as the one that Gerasimov is describing, one in which Liman is now mostly captured by the Russians. If the Ukrainians have indeed been pushed back and now hold only 15% of Liman, it is likely that the remainder of the town will be cleared very soon, and it could be that we will be finally getting confirmation of Liman's fall and of Russia's consolidation over it at some point within the next days or weeks. Well, that's one important piece of news. The other important piece of news that Gerasimov gave was that another town, Barovaya, which is located to the south of Kupiansk on the east bank of the Oskol River, has now also been captured, and captured fully, by the Russians. Now, Barovaya is in some respects an interesting place in that it was captured by the Russians in 2022. The Ukrainians recaptured it during their Kharkiv 2022 counteroffensive. And since then, until very recently, there's been very little fighting, or at least very little reported fighting, in this area. Then a few weeks ago, reports started to appear that the Russians were indeed moving towards recapturing Borovoye, that they'd taken various settlements and villages to the north of Borovoye, that they were advancing southwards along the east bank of the Oskol, and that a storming operation of Borovoye was about to begin. Well, if Gerasimov is telling the truth, and for the record, I am sure he is, after he spoke, the Russian Defense Ministry formally confirmed the recapture of Borovoye. Well, if Gerasimov is telling the truth, then Borovoye has now indeed been recaptured. And by universal admission, this is the beginning of the collapse of Ukrainian positions, of the remaining Ukrainian positions east of the Oskol River. Moreover, if Liman, Sviatogorsk, another town in this area which the Russians are currently besieging, and Borovoye are all recaptured by the Russians, and in light of the fact that the Russians now indisputably control Kupiansk again, then that leaves only two places, two towns recaptured by Ukraine in the autumn of 2022 in Ukraine's one successful offensive of the war, indisputably successful offensive of the war, the Kharkov 2022 counteroffensive. That leaves only two important towns that the Ukrainians recaptured during that counteroffensive, Izium and Balaklaya, still under Ukrainian control. And the fall of Borovoye would potentially reopen the way for the Russians to cross the Oskol River and to recapture Izium and ultimately Balaklaya, which lies further to the west. And that would essentially erase Ukraine's gains from its Kharkov 2022 offensive in a very different situation on the battlefronts today from the one that we had in 2022. It would bring much closer the complete encirclement of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and it would potentially, in combination with various other things that have been happening in northeastern Ukraine, open the way for a Russian advance on Kiev. I still think this is quite a long way off. I still think that the Russian priority continues to be Donbass. That has been the Russian priority throughout the start, throughout this entire war. But these latest developments, the fall of Borovoye, the probable imminent fall of Liman, the potential fall thereafter of Izium, all of these would indeed suffice, in my opinion, to make Zelensky panicky and worried, and might lead him to make the kind of statements that he was making yesterday. Well, there it is. The one thing that Zelensky is not prepared to do ever is to seriously engage the Russians in negotiations to end the war. His chief of staff, Kirill Budanov, who has consistently now for some time sought a negotiated end to the war, has made further comments to this effect. Budanov has flipped, in a kind of a way, the current narrative that the Ukrainians are doing well on the battlefronts to say, well, if so, isn't this a good moment to negotiate with the Russians and come to an agreement with them? That's what Budanov, in effect, has been saying. But Zelensky himself remains, so far as I can see, categorically, adamantly opposed to this idea. And, well, he continues to be opposed to this idea, in part because the Europeans continue to back him in this stance. There is no sign, in my opinion, of any serious move in Europe to find a negotiated resolution to this war. In December, the Europeans had a discussion about the idea of restarting negotiations with the Russians, but they've made no movement in that direction since then. Macron sent two representatives to Moscow, but the Russians found them completely completely unwilling to countenance any concessions. They still insisted that it was Russia that was the aggressor, that it was Russia that needed to make the big compromises. So the Russians sent those two French representatives away. The Europeans are unable to agree on a lead negotiator to negotiate with the Russians. And the Europeans have never fully defined anyway what exactly it is they think negotiations should lead to. They've never come up with anything that might be considered, conceivably considered, a reasonable negotiating plan. Officially, they remain committed to Ukraine joining NATO, to Ukraine joining the EU, to Ukraine receiving reparations from the Russians. They continue to insist that any ceasefire, which is the one thing that they do incessantly demand, should be a ceasefire on the existing front lines, that there should be no suggestion of any withdrawal by the Ukrainians in any part of the front lines. And the idea is that this ceasefire should only be a temporary transitional arrangement pending an eventual complete Russian withdrawal from every part of what the Ukrainians still say, or what the Europeans still say, is occupied Ukraine, which of course includes Crimea as well. All of that continues to be the official European position. And you find many people in Europe who continue to insist that that must remain the common stance. Kaya Kallas, Europe's so-called foreign minister, refuses in any way to row back from this position. She recently said, as I discussed in an earlier program, that there's no point in even talking to the Russians at the present time, because the Russians show no interest in negotiating what Kaya Kallas and the Europeans consider should be a just and lasting peace. The just and lasting peace would be the acceptance by the Russians of all of these demands that the Europeans are making. And Kaya Kallas is hardly alone here. She's supported in this stance by the Baltic states and by the British. And frankly, I don't get the sense that the other big states, the governments of the other big EU states, Germany and France, certainly whilst Merz and Macron remain in overall control, I get no sense that they're prepared to move from that position either. So given that this is indeed Europe's stance, Zelensky is under no real pressure to begin negotiations. The Americans might want him to make concessions, but the Americans, precisely because they reduced the level of their military support to Ukraine, but have never shown any intention of ending it entirely, appear to have, well, I won't say lost leverage over the Ukrainians, but lost credibility with the Ukrainians, because the Americans repeatedly show that they're not prepared to use the immense leverage over the Ukrainians that they actually have. So Zelensky, he may be very afraid that the Russians might indeed before long come for him, but he's not so afraid at the moment that he's prepared to shift in any way his current negotiating position. Now, as it happens, his former press secretary, Yulia Mendel, fresh from a devastating interview about Zelensky that she has given to Tucker Carlson. Anyway, Yulia Mendel has actually said that it is all but physically impossible for the Russians to carry out a successful decapitation strike against the Ukrainian leadership. Zelensky's command bunker in Kiev is located far below the ground surface. It was built in Soviet times by the Soviet Union to withstand attacks by nuclear weapons. Even an Oreshnik would not be able to penetrate. And of course, there's doubts about whether an Oreshnik actually has capabilities to penetrate deep under the surface. Anyway, just saying. But anyway, even with nuclear weapons, using nuclear weapons, according to Mendel, it would be all but impossible to destroy this bunker and Zelensky inside it. And from the way she speaks, and I suspect she's right, Kiev has several of these command bunkers. And altogether, it would be very, very difficult for the Russians to conduct a decapitation strike unless it was done with minimal notice and completely by surprise, which of course it might be. But anyway, there it is. For the record, my own view is that Zelensky is indeed becoming increasingly nervous. What is making him nervous is the situation on the front lines and his gradual realization that the fall of Donbass is indeed coming. So anyway, that is Zelensky. On the European side, what we see is not pressure or not readiness to indulge or engage the Russians in negotiations. It is instead further confrontational policies And intensifying drive, or so you might think, towards remilitarization and preparations for war. And the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, has now called together the heads of Europe's military industrial complex, Rheinmetall, the Czech weapons manufacturers, the French ones, all of them. He's called them together in what looks to me, if I have to be honest, like a crisis meeting. There's lots of assurances that that is not what this is. We're told that Rutte regularly meets with the heads of Europe's, let's call it, military industrial complex, or at least its companies. But this meeting, organized in that way and bringing everybody together, coming on top of all sorts of reports that European officials are becoming increasingly concerned about the situation with arms production. As I said, it does suggest to me something different, something which does actually point to something of a mood of crisis. And, well, the explanation isn't difficult to find. Europe has indeed increased spending on weapons very considerably, indeed, massively, in fact, over the last few years. But as Kaja Kallas, the EU's foreign minister, recently pointed out, there's been lots of money spent. There's been huge numbers of contracts signed. In fact, Rheinmetall is said to be drowning under a sea of contracts. But so far, there is very little to show for it all. There's been no increase in production of air defense systems. No increase, no significant increase in production of tanks and armored vehicles. There's been many claims that shell production in Europe has increased. I have strong reasons to doubt that this is the case, by the way. Those reports, those claims have been made before, and they've always turned out to be wrong. There's been a definite ramp up in production of drones. But even here, the Europeans are unable to compete with the Russians. And in fact, my sense is that the gap is growing. So what Mark Rutte appears to be trying to do is to bring all of the chiefs of Europe's defense industry companies together into a single room and to basically badger and bully and lecture them into producing more. One of the most curious things about this meeting is that apparently the heads of these companies are saying that they're not able to increase production unless they're given definite signed cast iron costed contracts to do so. But Mark Rutte apparently is saying that they should dispense with all of that. They should just increase production, forget about contracts or such finickety pieces of red tape, that's what he would say, and just produce arms production anyway, which is basically the Secretary of General of NATO telling all of these companies, the vast majority of which, by the way, are privately owned, that they should extend indefinite credit to NATO and to European governments and simply produce weapons and incur what are likely to be very high costs with no promise or guarantee that they will ever be paid. Now, I'm going to say straight away that that is a fantastic idea. Indeed, it is an absurd one. And it perhaps tells us more than anything how desperate and frustrated European leaders are becoming. To repeat again a point I have said many times, in order to ramp up production to match the volumes that the Russians are now producing, and not just to equal the Russians, but to surpass them, what the Europeans would need to do would be to carry out a complete root and branch reorganization of their entire industrial structure. And that doesn't just involve the specialized armaments companies. It must extend to large parts of civilian industry and to suppliers further down the supply chains as well. That is a multi-year task. It also probably requires a significant part of European industry being brought under state control. And realistically, it simply isn't going to happen. So we're starting to see the mirage of the European military build-up start to dissipate. And in Germany, which has been leading the charge on this matter, I suspect that when the implications of this hit home, the vast amount of money has been spent and has delivered virtually nothing. I suspect at that point, Chancellor Merz's political difficulties, which are already increasing, are going to multiply to the point where he's going to find it impossible, assuming he is still there, to stay on. So it's an interesting meeting and a very revealing one, as were Kaja Kallas's previous words. It doesn't surprise me in the least. In fact, it is exactly what I anticipated would happen. To say it also very simply, the current European political elite, the people who run the European Commission and the people who run the NATO Secretariat, as well as most of the people you now find at the heads of national governments across Europe, are almost the last people you would want to put in charge of a major industrial recovery and rearmament drive. It's something so far outside their knowledge and experience and indeed imagination that if you look at them, you would know that it simply can't be done. The days when Europe could produce technocrats like Jean Monnet, who knew in the 1940s how to revive French industry, are long gone. And even if such people existed, they would be operating in an administrative and political, and to some extent, economic vacuum. And it's difficult to see how even they would succeed. Well, if the European Union cannot generate weapons, and by the way, what I've said about the European Union applies equally to Britain as well. In Britain, the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, trying desperately to hold on to his position as Prime Minister, as everything falls apart around him. Anyway, he's now talked about a further entirely unaffordable and unplanned, as far as I can see, £18 billion boost to defence spending. Why he thinks that's popular, by the way, I have no idea. Anyway, apart from, as I said, generating or spending money, pursuing impossible targets, the other thing that the Europeans are good at is sanctions. And they continue to mass produce more and more sanctions. I don't think they've caught up or come close to catching up with the Americans here. The Americans, of course, being the world's biggest source of sanctions. But they are trying and they're working very hard at this. And they've now expanded their sanctions regime again. And interestingly, their latest sanctions no longer target companies in Russia or businesses in Russia. They're expanding increasingly to sanctioning companies that are not Russian, companies that have some dealings with Russia or Russian entities, and in particular, Chinese companies and businesses, which appear to be at the moment the prime target. The Chinese have reacted very, very sourly to this, as you might expect. And apparently they're already starting to take countermeasures against the EU, as you would expect them to do. To repeat again, European sanctions, the endless train of sanctions that we have seen since February 2022, or perhaps more properly, since June 2014. Cumulatively, they have failed to bring down the Russian economy. In fact, what they're doing is creating a push towards reindustrialization and technological sovereignty, the pursuit of technological sovereignty in Russia, whose economy, since the introduction of the sanctions in 2014, has grown significantly faster than the European economies have done over that same period. Anyway, notwithstanding that, notwithstanding that the sanctions are and have been and will continue to be unsuccessful, the Europeans now seem intent to take on the mightiest industrial power of them all by far, which is, of course, China. And, well, I have to say that I've come to the conclusion that the Chinese, who've been very forbearing about all of this up to now, are now very much, very close to losing patience. And not only have they started to take countermeasures against Europe, the European industries and European companies, but my suspicion is that China is going to start to to end, going to start to work towards an economic divorce from Europe on its own. On the one hand, Europe, of course, remains for China a huge and attractive market for Chinese goods. But other markets for those goods are now developing around the world. And as I have always pointed out, a long-term successful business relationship is based first and foremost on trust between the parties. And this European habit of sanctioning the Chinese and sanctioning everybody that trades with Russia, or increasingly so, with China particularly targeted, well, all that ultimately does is that it undermines trust, eventually to the point when the Chinese will say, well, this is far too difficult a market. Let's not focus too much on it. Let's think instead of doing business somewhere else. And, well, a reduction of trade with China might benefit some European businesses, but I expect it's going to do significantly more harm to others. In the end, I cannot see how this benefits Europe. Europe currently is in a difficult relationship with the United States. The United States has engaged Europe in what amounts to trade wars recently with Donald Trump's tariffs. The United States is now pulling 5,000 troops out of Germany. They've apparently announced the cancellation of a deployment of 4,000 troops to Poland. So the Europeans' relations with the Americans isn't that good. The Europeans' relations with the Russians have, to all intents and purposes, collapsed. And one would have thought that it would not be a particularly good idea to damage relations further with the third remaining great power, which is China. But that, it seems, is what the Europeans also are seeking to do. So we have this extraordinary situation where the Europeans have bad relations with all three of today's great powers, are intent on prolonging their war, their proxy war, against one of them, which is Russia. And they are unable to formulate any sort of plan, either how they can win the war, because there is no plan in Europe to win the war against Russia, or how to end the war, because there is no agreement in Europe about ending the war, or how to negotiate with the Russians in any way that the Russians would find meaningful or realistic. So the situation drags on, and the war drags on, and with every day that passes, Ukraine loses more territory and more people and more of its economic system, and its long-term crisis grows deeper. Now, at this point, one has to confront again the current narrative that Ukraine is doing well and that Russia is doing badly. I am unable to reconcile any of that with the ongoing realities. It is at the moment, Russia's economy, which is growing, and even with the problems that we saw at the start of this year, it appears to be growing faster than Europe. As has been pointed out by several, Russia is funding the war in Ukraine without increasing its debt load, which is, by the way, remarkable. But debt to GDP ratio in Russia remains below 20%. There's been claims that the banking system is becoming overextended, but reports from the central bank that deposits in Russian banks are growing argues against that theory, just to say. So Russia has avoided debt. It's having no problems or difficulties producing weapons. It's having no problems or difficulties recruiting soldiers. In Ukraine, we see the economy under, well, intense pressure to the extent that it even functions organically anymore. We see violent recruitment on the streets of Ukraine every day. We see Russian attacks across Ukraine, the entire territory of Ukraine, from the sky every night with an air defense system that is barely functioning. And, well, as I discussed earlier in the program, we see the Russians are, in fact, steadily gaining ground on the battlefronts, with the remainder of Donbass in jeopardy and likely soon to fall. These narrative arcs, in my opinion, have been disastrous. They fostered periods of dangerous complacency and overconfidence in the West, which have largely brought us to precisely this position in which we are in today, with no intellectual plan, no plan about how to get out of a crisis in Ukraine and with Russia, which is worsening, but which no one seems willing to acknowledge. Now, saying all of this, we also now have the looming crisis in the energy markets and in the financial markets, with a sense that the failure from an American point of view of the summit meeting in China has now undermined confidence in precisely those markets. Now, it's not entirely clear what President Trump thought he would achieve whilst he was in Beijing. But as I discussed in a recent program, it does seem as if some people in the US did think that the United States, that Trump, might be able to persuade Xi Jinping and China to increase pressure on Iran, at least to allow commercial traffic to pass unrestricted through the Strait of Hormuz. Well, as I discussed in my program yesterday, none of that happened. There was no promise to that effect made by the Chinese at all. At least there isn't a single document produced by the Chinese which suggests that this was the case. From the Chinese point of view, the main issue of the summit was that warning about Taiwan that I discussed at length in my program yesterday. And it is clear, by the way, that that warning hit home. Donald Trump has gone back to Washington. He seems suddenly very unsure whether to proceed with a major arms sale to Taiwan. He's saying that only he knows what he's going to do. And frankly, at the moment, I get the sense that even he doesn't know. I think the warning did unsettle him. Whether it unsettles him enough, as it should, by the way, to affect his policies and to make him pull back from US support from Taiwan, well, that is a completely different matter. But anyway, my point is that the Chinese gave no hint that they are prepared to help the Americans get themselves out of the mess they're in with Iran and with the situation in the energy markets and in the Strait of Hormuz. And it should be said again that there doesn't seem to be any coherent plan from the United States to resolve this problem. I read yesterday in the Financial Times that just as Europe's grandiose plan for a massive increase in weapons production appears to be costing an awful lot of money, but achieving very little, so President Trump's $40 billion plan to provide US government insurance to commercial vessels that want to transit the Strait of Hormuz has amounted to absolutely nothing. There have, in fact, been zero takers. Not a single ship owner, not a single ship has taken out insurance as a result of this scheme. Apparently, the ship owners are telling the United States that they're only willing to look at this offer of insurance if their ships are provided with US Navy escorts. And I think that the US Navy is very unwilling to put its warships at risk by sending them and deploying them for extended periods in the Strait of Hormuz, at risk of attack by Iranian missiles and drones, in order to provide those escorts. And, of course, in the absence of any sustained effort by the US Navy to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the energy markets, the financial markets, are beginning now, I think, finally, to face up to the reality of the situation and to become increasingly nervous. The option of renewing the air offensive against Iran doesn't look attractive. The Iranians have shown that they have the ability to mount massive counterattacks, and the Saudis, for one, are very worried about their desalination plants and fear the stupendous consequences if Iran did attack those plants and they were put out of action. The United States must also address the fact that its own weapons inventories are now disastrously depleted and that it will take years to rebuild them, and that Iran apparently still has very large numbers of missiles and drones in its arsenal. So a renewal of the US air offensive seems unattractive. I recently did a program on the wonderful new channel hosted by Jim Webb. Over the course of that program, Jim Webb, who has a background in the US military, informed me of successful Iranian hits on US aircraft that were overflying Iran, that several American aircraft had been hit over and above those that we know of, which were shot down. And he spoke of technology that Iran possesses that does enable Iran, at least to a certain degree, to track the movement of F-35 stealth fighter jets. So a renewal of the air offensive does not look like an attractive idea. The third option, which is a ground operation against Iran, would take many months to organize, would be massively controversial in the United States, especially as presumably it would require the call up of reservists. And by the way, based on the terrain and the geography, which is very difficult, and the size of the Iranian military, which is substantial, and the fact that that military is being supplied definitely by the Russians, for example, with FPV drone technology. Such an offensive, such a ground operation, even if it could be launched, would be extremely costly and might not succeed. So the president's options do not seem very good on the military side, and his attempts to get the Chinese on side without making any concessions or showing any willingness to acknowledge Iranian concerns, well, that, it seems to me, has also failed. So it's not surprising that the markets are beginning to become worried. Apparently, there was a major sell-off of bonds around the world yesterday. Yields are rising. Inflationary pressures are growing. There's been much discussion about whether it would be the correct thing at this time for the central banks, the Western central banks, to raise interest rates in order to counter these inflationary pressures. I am not expert in these things, so I'm not going to express a view on what would be right and what would be wrong. What I would say is that if, in conditions of rising inflation, with very, very high debt levels right across the West, debt levels borne by governments, debt levels borne by companies, and above all, by individuals, increased interest rates at a time of higher inflation is going to put many, many people and many businesses under extremely high pressure. A recession, a severe recession, one that takes in all of the West, to me, in that case, looks all but unavoidable. So the options are not good, and the markets are becoming nervous. And I have to say this, I don't get the sense that President Trump, the administration, have a clear plan. They continue to enforce the blockade on Iran, but it seems that more and more ships carrying oil destined for China continue to get through, and the US is wary of interfering with that traffic. The Iranians, therefore, are still receiving an income stream, and they anyway now have reliable cross-border contacts, commercial contacts and supply routes through Central Asia and across the Caspian Sea from Russia and via Pakistan too. There has, by the way, been a foreign ministers meeting of the BRIC states in India, chaired by the Indian foreign minister, Mr. Jai Shankar. Lavrov attended, so did the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. He had apparently a very friendly meeting with Jai Shankar, which suggests that the recent problems in Iranian-Indian relations have been smoothed over. The BRIC states were unable to come up with a joint statement because of opposition from the UAE, which is, by the way, a BRIC state, which is unhappy with any statement that appeared to give support to Iran. But my overall impression is that the remaining BRIC states tilt very strongly in Iran's favour in this crisis and are still willing, or continue to be willing, to give it economic and diplomatic support. So, what does the president do? At the moment, he doesn't seem to want to negotiate or retreat. He continues to make fiery statements about how unacceptable the Iranian demands are. But without the Chinese stepping in to redress the situation, the balance, the situation in the markets and in the economy overall continues to deteriorate. Now, this ought to be a concern to the Europeans too, given that they actually more directly affected by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz than the Americans are. I would have expected the Europeans to be especially keen at this time to bring the ongoing conflict in Ukraine to an end. Europe can hardly bear the weight of two wars at the same time. But, as I said, they have no plan to end the war, no sign of being able to formulate one. They instead hide inside this mirage that they don't need to make any concessions or any moves to end the war, because Ukraine supposedly is winning, the Russians supposedly are losing. It may have little connection to reality, but it does give the Europeans the excuse to do that which it seems they want to do at this time, which is precisely nothing. Now, this is where I'm going to finish the program. Today, I'm going to say that in my opinion, over the next few weeks, the situation on the front lines is going to intensify. If Lyman falls soon, with Konstantinovka likely to fall shortly after, well, this narrative of Ukraine holding its own is going to start to wear very thin. But, well, for the moment, it continues to be plugged relentlessly. When the realities hit home, I expect that we're going to see the biggest panic in Europe that we have seen at any point in this war up to now. Well, that's the end of my program today. Let me remind you, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Don't forget, if you like this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.